This is Grow in Grace, a daily teaching ministry of Palmetto Baptist Church in Greenville, South Carolina. As we've studied the book of Daniel, we've seen that God rules and His kingdom matters more. Throughout the book, we have regular reminders as God reveals visions and dreams to His servant Daniel. Today, Pastor Sam Horn will begin a sermon from Daniel chapter 11, where Daniel records his final vision from God, titled, Meet the Antichrist. Let's listen together so we can grow in grace.
Daniel chapter 11. We're going to be looking at the last part of that chapter this morning, and as I was sort of making my way through getting my thoughts together and exploring that text this week, I got curious about how many sermons in Daniel we have enjoyed together over the last almost year now. And we have enjoyed 20 sermons. This is our 20th sermon in the book of Daniel. If the Lord had not given us all of the divine interruptions that He has given to us over the last year, we would have made our way to this point in the book of Daniel in about 5 months. And so I began to ask myself, Lord, 5 months is a long time to be in a book. Almost a year is even longer. Is it really worth the time to spend this amount of time in a book like Daniel that is filled with mysterious prophecies that are delivered in apocalyptic language that, especially in the last half of the book, are all about dreams and visions, about times that are either so far in our past history or so far in the future that we almost wonder what the relevance to all of this is? Now, I know if I had that question, I'm sure some of you have been asking that question. And so this morning, what I'd like to do as we come to the book of Daniel is I'd like to give you at least one good answer to that question that comes at the very end of our text. And I'll do that as we go through the sermon. But I think part of the answer lies in how we have established in our thinking what this book really is. This is far more than just a book of prophecy. We noted at the very beginning that this book is a wisdom book, and it contains a unique wisdom that God has for the nations and a unique wisdom that God has for His people. And we've been hearing this wisdom now for all of these months. You should be able to say it in your own mind and in your own heart as I repeat it out loud. This is a wisdom from God to the nations, and what He wants the nations to know is that God rules over the kingdoms of men. And then there's this unique wisdom, this sort of special wisdom that He has for His people who are in captivity, and that wisdom is that His kingdom matters more. It matters more than all the glory and the beauty and the honor of the kingdoms around them and the kingdoms that they're going to be called to submit to. That wisdom was given to Daniel in the course of more than 60 years of living in Babylon under three empires. He started off in Jerusalem in the kingdom of Judah. As a young man in chapter 1, he comes to Babylon, spends his entire life serving Nebuchadnezzar, and then there are three kings that are not named, and then at the end, he serves one of Nebuchadnezzar's grandsons, Belshazzar, who we met in chapter 5. And then the Babylonian Empire falls to the Persian Empire, and Darius, or Cyrus the Great, comes to power, and as we meet Daniel in the last part of the book, he is receiving visions during the time of Cyrus, during the second great empire that we read about in the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel is going to primarily treat five major kingdoms. From Daniel's day all the way to the end of the age, the book of Daniel is going to talk about five kingdoms. If you want to get the book of Daniel in your head, it has to do with these five kingdoms. There is the kingdom of Babylon. By the time we get to chapter 11, that's done. There's the kingdom of Persia. Daniel is in the kingdom of Persia, and then the kingdom that's about to come is the kingdom of Greece, Alexander the Great. And that kingdom is going to be the kingdom that most of the rest of the book of Daniel addresses. The things that you read about in chapter 8, the things that we've been reading about in chapter 10 and 11, all take place in that kingdom, the kingdom of Greece, that started with Alexander the Great and broke up into these four kingdoms. And as we get even further into chapter 8 and into chapter 11 especially, two of those kingdoms that are part of Alexander's empire, the north, the Syrian kingdom, and the south, the Egyptian kingdom, come into play. And so most of what we're talking about takes place in that third kingdom. And that kingdom, as we went back in chapter 8, talks about at the end of that age, toward the end of that kingdom, God has ordained the rise of a political leader that is described for us in chapter 8 as a little horn with a great mouth that speaks bold and arrogant things against God and that acts in ruthless ways against God's people. And we're going to meet that person here in our text this morning. Now that person is going to run into the fourth kingdom, and that's Rome. We're going to meet Rome right in our text. There's a little part of our text that talks about ships that come from a place called Kittim. And the ships of Kittim are actually ships that bring Roman legions with them, and they're going to meet this arrogant ruler, and they are going to put a stop to all that he is doing. And so we, for the first time in Daniel, we are going to meet this fourth kingdom that we saw back in chapter 2 and in the vision of chapter 7, and it's the kingdom of Rome. And the last half of our chapter takes us all the way to the end of that kingdom, and we're going to find another individual that is described for us very similarly as a little horn with an arrogant mouth, and he is going to do even greater evil and even greater blasphemy, and he's going to create even more chaos and more spiritual damage than any other ruler who has ever lived on the earth up to that point in time. And so Daniel is trying to make sense of all of this. What I just repeated to you is what Daniel has been trying to wrestle with. And as he thinks about what's coming for his people, he had no idea that at the end of the 70 years of captivity, what was going to be introduced for them as they went back to their land and rebuilt Jerusalem and rebuilt the temple and reestablished the worship, what Daniel anticipated is not what God revealed. What God revealed would happen to them after they got back to their place was that there would be an extended, prolonged, intense conflict. And that conflict is described for Daniel in chapter 9. Daniel, if you want to know what is going to happen to your people, because your expectation and your anticipation has not been met, here's what's going to happen. They are going to be engaged in this prolonged, massive conflict that is going on in two realms. We noted in Daniel chapter 9 and in the first part of Daniel chapter 10 that there are armies in heaven that are fighting, and actually some of them are controlling what is happening to the armies on earth. And that's the first time in the book of Daniel that we have any idea of the magnitude of what's really going on. And so Daniel stands there stunned, and he wants to know something. And I've had this very same question in my own life about myself, and I'm sure you have in your life. He wants to know, what is going to happen to me and what's going to happen to my people? Has God ever revealed something to you? Has God ever introduced something to you that was so different from what you expected that it took you back? It didn't shake your faith. It didn't shake your love in the Lord. It didn't shake your commitment to being an obedient Christian, but it took you back. And as you tried to process what was going on and what the Lord appeared to be revealing, maybe you had this question that Daniel has, and that is, Lord, what is going to happen to me? And what is going to happen to my family? What's going to happen to me? And what's going to happen to my people? And God is going to give the answer to those two questions in the rest of the book. Daniel is going to find out what happens to him at the end of the book in chapter 12. But he's going to find out what's going to happen to God's people in these four visions that we've been looking at. The first vision is in chapter 7. It's the panoramic view of the history of the ages of the empires. Then in chapter 8, he gets the next vision. Vision number 2 is all about the third kingdom, the kingdom of Greece. God's people are back in their land. This is 300 years ahead of Daniel. God's people are back in the land. They've rebuilt their temple. They're worshiping their city. They're back as a nation, and all of a sudden, the empire of Greece rises up. And as you think about that empire, there are two pieces of it, the Syrians and the Egyptians, and they go to war with each other. And as they go to war with each other, Israel is right in the middle, and it has catastrophic impact on the people that Daniel cared about. And so he says to God, God, what are you up to? And it's like God puts everything on pause, all this stuff about the battles between the kings of the north and the kings of the south on pause, and he stops all of the action, and it's like he comes personally to Daniel, and he says, Daniel, let me tell you what I'm doing. Your people are at the center of what I'm doing. And there are 70 weeks of years that have been ordained for them. And by the time those weeks are done, my Messiah will have accomplished six massive things. He will have finished transgression. He will have put an end. He will have destroyed transgression. No more transgression. He will make an end to sin. He will atone for iniquity. He will bring in everlasting righteousness. He will fulfill every prophecy and complete every promise. And at the end, he will anoint a most holy place. We saw this in Daniel chapter 9, verse 24. Daniel, that's what I'm up to. This is way bigger than just your people. This is way bigger than just the temple in Jerusalem. This is way bigger than just the country of Israel. This is global. This is cosmic in nature. What I'm up to, Daniel, has global implications, and it has cosmic relevance, because by the time I am done, my messianic champion will have accomplished these things. And Paul is going to write this about this in Ephesians 1. He is going to restore all things to what they should have been from the beginning. Everything in heaven and everything in earth will be finally rightly related to the Creator. Daniel, that's what I'm doing. And then it's like he hits the play button again, and we go into the third vision, or the fourth vision, in chapter 10. And this vision goes all the way to the end. It's introduced by a man who is clothed in linen, and you're going to meet that same man at the end of chapter 12. And so he's like the bracket that talks to us about this particular vision. And by the time we get to our text this morning, we are reading about two individuals, one who is going to come and do a great deal of damage and do immense blasphemy against the God of heaven. He is going to seduce the people of God. He's going to put an end to the daily sacrifice. All of these things are going to happen. And all of this is going to happen through a ruler who is going to come just before Jesus arrives the first time. And then we're going to jump at the end of the passage. It's like God says to Daniel, I'm going to take you all the way to the end. And just before Jesus comes back the second time, you're going to meet another ruler who's very similar to the ruler that was there right before his first coming. Right before his second coming, there's going to be another similar ruler, but he's going to be much worse, and he's going to be much more blasphemous. And so this morning, I've entitled our message, Meet the Antichrist. And so we're going to do that this morning by looking at our text, and we're going to actually see this text through the lens of three perspectives. I want to give you three simple perspectives, and then I want to answer the question that I raised at the beginning. Why is it worth the time to read the book of Daniel? Well, first perspective is this, beginning in verse 21 and going all the way through verse 35. You meet sort of like the prototype of the Antichrist that you're going to see at the end. And so I've called this individual the sinful man who does whatever he wants. He is a self-willed man. And we're going to read about him in our text this morning. And the first thing that the text alerts us to is that there is a historical reality to his identity. Notice what you read in verse 21, in his place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given. So in order to understand verse 21, you got to dip back into verse 20. And what you saw in verse 20 was reference to a king, a northern king, a king of Syria. And this king would follow Antiochus III. We noted Antiochus III, that incredibly majestic and warlike king. He's off the scene. Somebody takes his place, and he's so desperate to fill the coffers so that he can replenish everything that Antiochus III spent in all of his wars that he sends a tax collector. And that tax collector, we actually know his name. His name is Heliodorus. Heliodorus. And he's actually in all the ancient literature. And what makes him famous is that his boss, King Seleucus IV, the guy who took over from Antiochus III is so desperate that he actually tells his tax collector, hey, when you get to a place, if they don't give you enough, go to their temples, because their temples are where they always keep their stash. So if you get to their temple, you take everything you can from them, then you get over to their temple and you find their stash and bring it. And this guy shows up in Jerusalem and he goes to the temple and he robs that temple. And in the century before Jesus arrived, there's actually literature that talks about this, and that's how we know his name. And so these are historical figures. Well, shortly after he robs the temple in Jerusalem, he goes back and he assassinates his boss. And so there's now an empty throne, and the person who's supposed to sit on that throne is being held in Rome, and that gives incredible opportunity for a very crafty person who has no right to that throne. And his name is Antiochus Epiphanes IV. And so he comes to power with craft and with cunning. This is exactly what the scripture says, and it is exactly what happened. This wicked ruler, Antiochus Epiphanes IV, comes at the very end of the third empire in Daniel's scheme. Empire number one is Babylon. Empire number two is Persia. Empire number three is Greece. And at the very end of the Grecian empire, this contemptible man stands up, seizes the throne, and begins to rule. And he has great power. He has unmeasured success, and he has unparalleled hostility toward the saints of God. Look at verse 24 and verse 25, and you'll see this. Without warning, he will come into the richest part of the province, and he will do what neither his fathers or his father's fathers have done. He will far surpass any Seleucid king before him. That's what is being said here. He will scatter among them plunder and spoil and goods. He will devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time. If you like to write in your Bible, that's a phrase you ought to underline. Verse 25, he will stir up his power in his heart against the king of the south. That's the Egyptian king. With a great army, and the king of Egypt, the king of the south, will wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army. But he, the king of the south, the king of Egypt, will not stand, for plots will be devised against him. This man has unmeasured success and great power, and he has unparalleled hostility against the saints of God. And we know his name. His name is Antiochus IV Epiphanes. He is a historical character that lived 150 years before Jesus was born. That's his identity. Notice his wicked activity in verses 22 through 32. He will exercise unstoppable military might. We just saw that as we read those verses together. He will operate out of a cunning heart. He will use deceptive words, and he will do whatever he wills. He is a self-willed man. Let me show you that in verse 22. Armies shall utterly be swept away. There's his incredible military might. And be broken, even the prince of the covenant, even the leader of God's covenant people. And from the time that an alliance is made, he will act deceitfully. There's his deceit. He will become strong, even though he is a small nation. Without warning, he will come into the richest part of the province. And we read that text just a moment ago. Verse 25, he will stir up his power and his heart. We read about that attack that he brings against Egypt. And then notice in verse 27, as for the two kings, Antiochus and the king of Egypt, they're going to sit down. Their hearts, the scripture says, are bent on evil. You're getting an idea of what these men are like. He will speak and act in unashamed blasphemy toward God. Look at verse 30 in our text. He shall turn back and pay attention at the end of verse 30 to those who forsake the holy covenant. Forces from him will appear and profane the temple. In other words, he's going to send people that represent his power and his authority, and they're going to do things in the temple of God that are shocking. He will take away the regular burnt offering, and they will set up an abomination that is so terrible and so defiling that it empties the temple and makes it desolate. Later in Scripture, you read about an abomination like this called the abomination of desolation. It is something so profane and something so defiling that it renders the temple inoperable because the temple has been defiled. This man is going to do all of that, and he will have unmitigated hatred toward God and toward his people. In fact, he's going to come into the land, into this beautiful land, and he's going to seduce God's people into a brand new way of living called Hellenism, in which they will worship the gods of Greece. They will adopt the sort of the morals of Greece. They're going to become very much Antiochus's people, and they're going to follow his gods, they're going to follow his morals, and they're going to follow his way of living. And this man in the text, we are told, has a wicked heart. His heart is bent on evil. And this man, for a period of time, is going to be granted power over God's own people. That's pretty stunning. But there are limits. All through this text, God has been putting little statements to remind us that as powerful and as willful and as successful and as arrogant and as defiling as this man is, and as apparently unstoppable as he is, he has limits that God has put upon him. There are divine boundaries around him. And you see this especially in verse 29. Look at verse 29. At the time appointed. There's an appointed time for something that's about to happen. And the person doing the appointing is not seen in the text, but you've been reading about him, you've been seeing his irresistible power, his sovereign might, and his unseen hand orchestrating everything in the book. In chapter 1, he's the one who gave the king of Judah into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. In chapter 2, we read that he's the one that gave Nebuchadnezzar the power that Nebuchadnezzar had over all of the earth. In chapter 4, he's the one that humbled Nebuchadnezzar. His hand appeared in chapter 5 and wrote on the wall of Belshazzar's palace in the midst of a blasphemous, arrogant feast. And it is this hand and this God that has ordained and appointed a time for this king. So what has he appointed? Well, if you look at the text, you see something interesting. In verse 29, he will return and come again to the south. So as you read the text before this, he goes down to Egypt, and he has a massive war, and he wins. And it is absolutely stunning what he does. He wins through deception. He wins through might. He devastates the army of Egypt, and he goes back to his land. And on his way back to his land, he stops and he messes around in Israel, and particularly in Jerusalem. But something happened at an appointed time. God has a place where he wants to get this man, and he has a means by which he's going to get him there. And so in Egypt, people are getting tired of the tribute they have to pay to Antiochus, and there is a rebellion that comes up, and Antiochus hears about this, and he gathers a massive army, and he decides, I'm going to go back to Egypt, and I'm going to teach those people once and for all who's really in charge of the world, and it's not them. And so as he goes back to Egypt, what we read about in verse 29 is something that's not even entering his mind, that all of this has been appointed. All of this has been ordained by an unseen hand that is much greater than him. And so we read in verse 29, at the appointed time, he will return and come into the south, that's Egypt, but it shall not be this time like it was before. In other words, he's not going to win. Why? For the ships of Kittim shall come against him. And for the first time in the text, God is introducing you to a kingdom that he is raising up, and it is the kingdom of Rome.
Thank you, Pastor Sam. We'll continue this sermon next time on Grow in Grace. Today's speaker is Dr. Sam Horn. He's the pastor for preaching and vision at Palmetto Baptist Church. PBC meets at 2730 Anderson Road, Greenville, South Carolina. If you live locally, come join one of our morning worship services at 9 or 10:45 a.m. every Sunday. You can find us online at pbcpowdersville.org. If you have any questions about today's message or about Palmetto Baptist Church, reach out to radio@pbcpowdersville.org. Grow in Grace is recorded by the audio team at PBC and produced by CJ Billieu. Join us again next time, so together we can grow in grace.